Good evening, everyone. Let me welcome you to this, the latest in our LUCY Visiting Research Speakers Programme. I'm very, very pleased to be able to welcome Dr. Joanna Hanson this evening. I'll give a full bio in just a sec, but it's certainly great to have her here. She's sort of been a friend of LUCY, I think, since the outset, since we were established a few years back, in her capacity as a research analyst at the Foreign Office. And having recently retired, it was a great pleasure that she accepted to come here and spend some time with us. And I think, you know, we are benefiting enormously from her practical experience. But she's also involved in a very interesting other project and has set up an NGO in Kosovo and is working. I'm sure she'll sort of be happy to sort of say a bit more about that and her activities in that regard. But why, by way of actual background, Joanna gained her PhD in Polish history, of all things, from the School of Slavonic and Eastern European Studies in 1978. She later held a research fellowship at the LSE International Studies Research Division, doing research on Polish-Jewish relations. In 1987, she joined the BBC Monitoring Service, working on Central European and Balkan reporting during the fascinating years of the 1989 collapse of communism and transition. In 1995, she joined the Foreign Office as a research analyst, providing advice and analysis mainly on Poland, Albania, Macedonia and Kosovo, but also on climate change. During that time, she continued to research and publish on Polish history and Balkan issues. Her main historical publication is The Civilian Population and the Warsaw Uprising of 1944, which was published by Cambridge University Press in 1982 and a revised version in 2004. She retired from the Foreign Commonwealth Office in 2013 and is now concentrating her efforts on research on and activism in civil society in the Southern Balkans and researching Anglo-Polish relations during the Solidarity period. During her talk, she's going to be trying to make an assessment of what the real objective of the 2013 Belgrade-Pristina normalisation agreement was and whether it was common to all sides, what it has achieved so far, the nature of its implementation, and is it a model which could be replicated? Joanna.
Thank you very much, James. Thank you very much for coming. It's good to be here. I'm talking really as somebody who, having worked on the Balkans, quite by chance, in fact, because I think, as James said, he came into the Foreign Office as a Polish expert, but there wasn't a Polish slot. And they said to me, would you like to work on the Balkans? So I won't really tell you what I said. I thought at least I'd get my foot in the door. And so I ended up working on the Balkans and, of course, as a result, worked on a lot of conflict. And having been there for however many years it was, something like 16, I think, and in particular on Kosovo, which I worked on and off on, I've watched this so-called normalisation process. And that was one reason why I decided to talk about this today. So I've been watching the development of this process, and I'm particularly interested in the aspects of change under the normalisation process, in people's fears of change and the myths about change that supposedly comes with normalisation. So I suppose my interest is really about the social impact of the process and what it means for the people. I don't come with any great theories, however. And I haven't used any specific methodology, I haven't had any sort of consistent research on this, but I speak more as a witness, as an observer, as I said, from a dozen or so years working on the process, and that was in Whitehall. And I worked as a research analyst, as James said, and a research analyst, we didn't just try and do a bit of research and write some analysis, but we also provided advice. Not that it was always listened to, but we provided advice on foreign policy. And I think that was very much where my interest in the normalisation process came, because I had one or two quite specific views. And as James has just said, I still travel there, and this NGO I've set up was partly set up on the back of the normalisation process one of our aims is to help people understand it and not fear it. So what I'm going to say tonight, these are mainly my sort of general thoughts and concerns around the subjects that James mentioned. In April 2013, the EU High Representative managed to achieve a situation whereby the supposedly antagonistic prime ministers of Kosovo and Serbia came to an agreement which was called the First Agreement of Principles Governing the Normalisation of Relations. This was a rather grand title for attempting to put into place the future status proposals for Kosovo, which public opposition in the north had disenabled. Today I would like to discuss to what extent that was a novel document, what its real objective was, and what exactly normalisation means, to what extent it has delivered, and perhaps say a few words about whether this is an example to follow. So, is it a novel document and its objectives? Prior to Kosovo's declaration of independence in March 2008, the former Finnish president, Martti Ahtisaari, at the request of the UN Secretary General, had put in place the comprehensive proposal for Kosovo status settlement, which I shall refer to here as the comprehensive proposal. This was done to further enable the fulfilment of UN Security Council Resolution 1244, to resolve the future status of Kosovo. These proposals include strong rights, positively discriminatory for the Serbian community there, to provide them with the stability and security to enable them to stay. These proposals were later included in the constitution and laws of the new Kosovo state. They are based on a strong decentralization principle, which required the creation of Serb-majority municipalities, including the splitting of the Mitrovica municipality. These decentralisation principles were largely implemented in the south of Kosovo when municipal elections were held there in 2009 in the new Serb-majority municipalities. Those proposals provided for the enhanced competences for the Serb-majority municipalities in the areas of education, health, culture, local economic development, urban planning, and enhanced rights in the appointment of police commanders. They allowed for cooperation with Serbian municipalities in Serbia and financial assistance transparently received from the Republic of Serbia, extensive municipal autonomy in financial matters, including the ability to receive transparent funding from Serbia. Provisions on inter-municipal partnerships and cross-border cooperation with Serbian institutions and the establishment of 6 new or significantly expanded Kosovo Serb majority municipalities. And of course, now we have the 4 in the north as well. Decentralisation was never implemented in the north, where the overwhelming Serb community refused to take part in the creation of those new municipalities and boycotted Kosovo elections. They continued to hold their own elections, sometimes but not always, under Serbian law, and ran what was called parallel authorities, although they were not really parallel to anything. They were the authorities. They had their own local government, police and law courts. It was a virtual no-go area for the Kosovo government. The normalisation agreement had one of its aims, to put an end to this parallel system and to hold municipal elections under Kosovan law. The process was set up by the European Union, specifically Baroness Ashton, one of the first real foreign policy buttons she took up, and following consultation with Hillary Clinton, after the International Court of Justice at The Hague decided that Kosovo's declaration of independence had not violated international law. The EU agreed to facilitate a dialogue to move Serbia and Kosovo forward following this advisory opinion. Her objectives, as stated then, were to remove obstacles that have had negative impact on people's lives, to improve cooperation and to achieve progress on the path to Europe. These obstacles were the technicalities. These talks have been through 2 stages. The first talks were focused very much on technical issues, the obstacles, as the Kosovo government was insistent that there would be no political discussion, nor was there any international support for them, nor were internal state issues, that is, the north, to be discussed. Whilst in the background there were many mutterings about the larger political ones which could not be avoided, it was sort of understood that this would be a longer, staggered process. The initial talks were called a dialogue. These technical talks dealt with such issues as the return of civil registries and cadastre records, freedom of movement, mutual recognition of university education diplomas, customs stamps, integrated border boundary, which are when you look at it, management, its borders for the Kosovars and boundaries for the Serbs, region and regional cooperation. The first talks were held with Kosovo Deputy Prime Minister Edita Tahiri leading the Pristina side and Borko Stanovic, a political director from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, on the Belgrade side. The talks started in March 2011, leading to the first signed agreements at the beginning of July and ending in December. In the midst of all these talks and related to the border stamp issues, Kosovo Prime Minister Hashim Thaçi attempted to gain control of the north when in July he sent in his Kosovo Rapid Reaction Force, ROSO, to take control of the border as a response to Serbia's failure to observe agreements, perceived agreements made on the stamps. This resulted in an armed attack by local Serbs on ROSO, a member of whom was killed. This produced a seriously exacerbated security situation with barricades being set up on roads leading to the north and bridges in Mitrovica. KFOR and ULEX, the rule of law mission of the EU, were not able to carry out their tasks. The whole of the north became organised to set in motion defence of their lands, the wail of fire alarms, and people flocked to barricades. KFOR soldiers and local Serbs were injured when attempts were made to remove the barricades. The north of Kosovo became a network of new roads, checkpoints, and illegal border crossing points to avoid these Western institutions' control. Final agreement and information on the customs stamps was reached 2 months later, in September. Trade was seen to grow, and Kosovo's imports to Serbia increased nearly twofold, but still far less than the side of imports from Serbia. It was against this background of agreements that Baroness Ashton said she would personally facilitate talks between Belgrade and Pristina, thereby ratcheting up the level of those talks. These talks form what I call the second stage and form political talks between the Kosovo and Serbian prime ministers. Towards the end of 2012, Cathy Ashton had decided that there would have to be political dialogue to move both the process forward and also the European perspective of the two countries. Prime Ministers Thaçi and Dačić held their first meeting with the High Representative in October. Then she stipulated her objectives were to improve the lives of people and help solve problems, and in doing so bring Kosovo and Serbia closer to the European Union. So again, her objectives were to improve people's lives and bring them closer to the EU and Europe. So what were the overall objectives of the two protagonists? The objectives of the Kosovo side negotiations were obviously to complete the comprehensive proposals process, and thereby the end of the supervision of the International Civilian Office, which was supervising the implementation of the settlement. This meant that Kosovo did not feel fully sovereign despite independence. These first stage technical agreements helped enable this. Supervised independence was ended in September 2012. The Kosovo government wanted to try and And the Kosovo government also wanted to try and exert its writ in the north, but had at the same time to counteract the nationalism of the Betevendosia movement, which was quite an important motivation. It was very much a political reaction to Betevendosia as opposed to getting above the Betevendosia activities. For both sides, there was obviously the European pull, but this was probably stronger in the second stage. Belgrade, I understand, wanted in particular, in relation to the second stage, to change the elites, to create an authentic Serb voice. It didn't want what it saw as collaborators. It wanted to move the North out of its illegal non-existence. Belgrave's policy is seen by many local Serbs, especially in the North, as disloyal, inconsistent, and they feel severely isolated and abandoned. But I'm not going to talk about these political aspects from the Serbian point of view. I meant to say this at the very beginning, as it's not my forte. So I'd be really interested to hear what you have to say. I'm not an expert on Serbian politics. You know, I look at it to the extent that it has some input here. Now I'm going to show you the agreement if I can get it up. So this is the agreement on normalisation. Concluding agreement, which was called the First Agreement of Principles Governing the Normalisation of Relations. And this title has made everybody say, well, if this is the first agreement, you know, how many more agreements are we going to have? It hasn't, just the title alone of the document hasn't instilled any confidence in the process. Because you talk about a first agreement, but nobody knows there's going to be another one. What sort of agreements there are going to be? And there's been, I've seen quite a lot of comment on this. And I think if you look at the document, which is only initialed and has no dates on it, it's hardly a piece of international treaty scripting, and it's full of ambiguities. If you look at the fifth principle, the association community will exercise other additional competencies as may be delegated by the central authorities. I mean, that is really difficult to understand what it means. And actually, it's been copied and pasted out of the law on local government, but for some reason has been put into the passive in this document. So the whole text is seen as being highly unclear, untransparent, and difficult to understand, and as a result of hiding some other agenda. People quite simply believe that an agreement has been made that they, or a lot of people quite simply believe that an agreement has been made that they don't understand. And there's great suspicion of it rather than perhaps reading it as a document, but maybe there wasn't a lot of thought put into it and there wasn't a lot of vision and there weren't a lot of ideas, and maybe it reflects that much more. So it's created, the facilitation talks created an agreement on the creation of an association of Serbian majority municipalities, on the structure of the Kosovo police force in the north, and in particular the integration of Serbian security structures into it, the integration of the judicial authorities in the north into the Kosovo legal framework, the holding of the municipal elections in the north under Kosovan law, and then the need to complete discussion on energy and telecoms by the 15th of June. That and the 14th principle are really the only two that don't specifically refer to the north of Kosovo. So this agreement was fundamentally about the north. And the 14th one is obviously very important, which is agreed that neither side will block or encourage others to block the other side's progress in their respective EU paths. I first of all would like to argue that what was agreed was really nothing new, but facilitated a process to complete the comprehensive status proposals. It did not start from scratch. It contained no new fundamental thinking, but was partly enabled because it was based on an approach of cooperation between the two sides and not recognition. There is nothing in the agreement referring to recognition, although, of course, many will argue that the agreement is implied recognition. The comprehensive status proposals also provided for the creation of an association of Kosovo municipalities based on the principles of the European Charter of Local Self-Government. The association is a new body, but it is provided for in both Kosovan and European law. The problem is that the two sides have a different perception of what its institutional form should be. The normalisation agreement provides for an extra layer of command in the police force, a regional commander for the four northern municipalities. But the manner in which he or she is selected is, as for local commanders in the proposals, and hence now in Kosovo law. Hence, I think it is fair to say that this first normalisation agreement was not anything new, but a final agreement to implement a system already in place in law. The only legal changes that were necessitated were amendments to three laws so far: the self-governance law, the law on the protection and promotion of rights of communities and their members, and the police law. Although there may have to be amendments to the education law soon. The self-government law was amended to rule the representation of the association in the Community Consultative Council at the President's office. A new amnesty law was passed, but it was an afterthought put into the implementation plan. This law is designed to help integrate the community and serve around northern Kosovo by ensuring that people cannot be prosecuted for their past resistance to Pristina authorities. So what has been achieved? What has happened to the three headings: improving people's lives, improving cooperation and progress to Europe? The first stage agreements were on freedom of movement, cadastral and civil registry records, diplomas, customs stamps, the IBM into boundary. What was it? IBM. Thank you. Regional representation, incorporation, energy, telecommunications, and some of these agreements have taken 4 years. I'm not going to go into details, but I'll give you just some idea. In 2011, the agreement on the first 2 points on the cadastral records and the recognition of diplomas was agreed, but they have not been implemented. The Serbian Constitutional Court declared them unconstitutional and said the Serbian government had to make them compatible with the constitution. But the Kosovan side has also failed to come up to scratch, does not pass the necessary legislation. So this means for people finding jobs, resolving property disputes, inheritance situations are all no easier. I think the Serbian government has just passed a decree, however, on the diplomas. Civil registry has been completed, as have the customs stamps. The IBM likewise is being completed by the building construction, although the two sides on the spot apparently do not talk to each other, but through Ulex. The most controversial failure has been the freedom of movement, because although in theory there is freedom of movement, it is expensive and cumbersome to implement, and this means people are not travelling. The issues revolve around the question of registration plates and insurance. And the whole registration plate issue is very complicated, because under UNMIC there were one set of registration plates, and then after independence Kosovo created its own registration plates with RKS on it and not KS, and in the not KS, and in the north the Serbs themselves don't always want to have those registration plates. Agreements have been made to resolve it, but it remains unresolved, and Serbia does not recognise the RKS ones. So people who can now travel to Serbia on ID cards from Kosovo but not passports, when they're going into Serbia, they have to buy temporary or pay for temporary license plates, which they then have to hand back when they come back. So it isn't as if they can buy them and come back again. And then there are also issues around insurance, because Kosovo is not part of the green card system. So people travelling into Serbia have to buy insurance, and the cost is at least €105 for a whole month. It's the same for people coming from the north to the south. depending on their number plates. They also have to buy insurance, but they can buy it on a weekly basis, so it does work out a bit cheaper. Albanians coming in from southern Serbia, from the Preševo Valley, have been allowed to come in without buying insurance, and this is seen by many people as being discriminatory. At one particular border point in Jarinje, you have to walk 1.5 kilometres to buy your insurance before you can actually cross the border and back again. So this is why this is one of the strongest criticisms, feel that not only have their lives not been improved, they've been made more difficult, they've been made more expensive, and it's become quite an issue for people travelling to Serbia for medical care. There has been a slight change over the last few days that Kosovars now can use their passports travelling to Serbia through third countries. But that, although the agreement was made in September, it was only, I think, announced yesterday. Agreement has certainly been made on Kosovo being able to hold its place in regional organisations, a right which had originally been blocked by Belgrade. The name Kosovo in membership lists has to appear with an asterisk and a reference to UN Security Council Resolution 1244 and the International Court of Justice ruling. And this created a lot of opposition and hard feeling in Kosovo, especially amongst civil society and Veta Mendoza. But Kosovo has now joined some important organisations, the Regional Cooperation Council, the Southeast European Cooperation Process, the Regional School of Public Administration, the Council of Europe Venice Commission, just to mention a few. And the Foreign Minister, Enver Hoxha, made his first official visit to Belgrade in October to an EU meeting of government ministers. Energy and communication agreements were only finally completed in September, but still need considerable implementation. Again, these are issues that have taken four years. So now let's look at what I've called the second stage, the first normalisation agreement. I shall start with the municipal elections because they unlock the rest. The municipal elections were held at the end of last year. They were regarded as a success despite the violence which occurred, resulting in reruns and the incredibly low turnout. This reflects a political immaturity in the north, that the turnout was so low, because these were elections in which they were electing their own representative in local government level. But at a level where they will have large decentralised powers. It is another example of the agreement that does not change the ethnic substance of the authorities in the north. It does not mean that suddenly a large number of local government officials from Pristina were going to come and run the local authorities. No, they have remained in Serbian hands, albeit different Serbian political hands, but I'll say more about this later. The establishment of a legal political force in the north has also been a relative success, insofar as it has been implemented to the letter of the agreement. 285 former MUP, the Kosovo police, the Serbian police officers functioning in the north, have been integrated into the Kosovo police, and a Kosovo police regional commander north established. They have been through a vetting and a retraining process, albeit only lasting a week. This required an amendment to the law on the Kosovo police, as a new police region had to be created, and specifically, the KP regional commander will be a Kosovo Serb nominated by the Ministry of Internal Affairs, but proposed by the mayors of the four northern Serbian municipalities on behalf of the association. These provisions created considerable dissatisfaction and protest by former MUP officers in the south, who were not given the same conditions. They were not given severance pay and pensions. The Serbian government is now supposed to be looking at this. It would not be easy to judge, however, as to whether this has improved the rule of law and how it would perform on ethnically based conflict situations. But it has happened calmly and is visible. The Serbian Protection Force, however, has not been dismantled, is visible and even recruiting new members. this causes particular concern, because although in theory they are more a kind of first responders to emergency floods, earthquakes, snow clearance, the Kosovo government sees them more as paramilitaries because of some of their previous activities. EU officials have also been reported as saying that they should be disbanded. It would appear, however, that recruiting is still going on, and this is certainly a very sensitive issue. A recent assessment by the Kosovo think tank, the Group for Political and Legal Studies, has remarked on the appearance of new private security companies, mostly employing former MUP officers and Civil Protection Corps members. It says this is a sign of Belgrade using different ways now of intervening in the north and sustaining the MUP presence. I would be a bit wary of this, as we saw similar patterns in Central European countries after the collapse of communism. So on the ground for the Serbian communities, little has changed. Same guys, albeit in different uniforms. Whether it has created a better rule of law situation is difficult to judge. It is still too early to judge how they are working together with other regional commanders. There is a belief that the loyalty of these new uniformed police officers is questionable. Although the other day when I was talking to some NGO representatives in Leposavić, one of them, I didn't really want to talk about it, but one of them said to me that they actually felt that since the change, that the what we call the re-uniformed police, the Kosovo police, were easier to work to than the sort of Serbian previous police force had been. The next big issue was the creation of an integrated judicial system. Here there has been virtually no progress. The parallel courts and prosecutors' offices remain open, despite having been closed. Salaries are still being paid. Parallel courts, however, say they're no longer accepting criminal and civil cases, which, according to one interlocutor I spoke to in the north, was a shame, as only recently the courts had finally started to address some of the criminal cases. It goes without saying that this has rule of law implications. An implementation plan has, however, been agreed on this matter, but is not being implemented and little progress is being made. The plan envisages one basic court and one basic prosecution office in Mitrovica. Much of the discussion regarding these courts is obviously around the ethnic composition of the judges and to some extent applicable law. The one totally new institution, the Association of Serb Majority Municipalities, which emerged from the negotiations and which probably was the most contentious of them all, still 18 months later has to be created. It is contentious because it is largely unknown. The Kosovan side perceive it as a threat to that country's sovereignty and unity, the suspicion of a new Republika Srpska, its territorial integrity. The Serbian side, as I have said, played up its role and appears to want to be more of a legislative and executive body. But we don't really know. And I want to stress here that the name is the Association of the Serb Majority Municipalities. It is not the Association of Serbian Municipalities, as it is often called. So this means that some of the Serbian municipalities in the south, which have other communities and also Albanians, should be members of this association. It will not be entirely, or it could not be entirely, Serbian. And it is expected, if it goes according to the way it's written at the moment, that it will have about 20 members. The association community of the Serb majority municipalities has two different names in each language and has two different concepts for each side. But I think this isn't really important. What's really important is the substance. The Kosovo government sees it as an association of local government municipalities based on its own, whereas Belgrade calls it a community which has much wider competencies and which should provide greater regional autonomy for the north. Some have even compared it to the Republika Srpska. The Pristina side has drawn up a draft for the association based on its own association of Kosovo municipalities, as it said it should be in the agreement. It presented this to the Belgrade side, or this is what they say, at the end of last year. But I think what they mean is they may have presented it to Brussels, who probably presented it. but they have had no response. The Belgrade side has appointed an implementation team, but so far with no result, although there are rumours that Belgrade has drawn up a draft. The average Serb in the north is not really, I don't think, too concerned about this institution. It is purely an instrument of the political elites. It is my personal view that Belgrade and or others are trying to use it to control the funding they are able to give to the municipalities. They want to use it as a vehicle to avoid Pristina. The Serbs are concerned about their jobs, pay and security. And when I asked them the other day what they would like the association to do, how they see the association as a body for the Serbian community, most of them again didn't want to talk on it, but one person only said, we want it as a voice to Belgrade, which I thought was quite interesting. But whatever, both sides have a totally different approach to this institution, whatever it is called. The agreement makes no suggestion that the association will have an executive role, but a purely representative role with a monitoring, undefined function. It appears to be a consultative and supportive body, more of a debating chamber, where the Serbian communities and other communities can put forward their ideas and views to both the municipal as well as central government. The association will be given a seat on the Communities Consultative Council, as it is defined in the English language agreement. It's different in each other agreement, in each other translation, which is located within the office of the president. It is not the one which is attached to the office of the government. This body has been in existence since 2008 and already has 5 members from the Serbian community, but it still needs to be considerably more effective and efficient. And it isn't entirely clear whether the thinking behind the association really wants to be a part of this council as well, because they see it as, Serbian side sees it as meaning that they are thereby recognising the Kosovan authorities. But none of these issues are really clear. And the Brussels agreement, rather like the enhanced competencies, gives the association the areas of responsibility of health, education, economic development, urban and rural planning. The information plan gives the Belgrade side the responsibility to draw up the statute. This should have been drawn up in October last year. It is rumoured that the Serbian side, the management team, whose members are all Belgrade appointees, has drafted the statute, as I said, but nothing has been published. They're probably waiting for the right political moment. And a quote from this, in January, Ljubomir Maric, a member of the management team, clearly said that the aim was to endow the association with as many powers as possible. As I've said, I believe its aim is to have control of the funding. It has also been suggested that there is an issue about which municipalities would be members, that there are some voices on the Belgrade side that really only want the 4 municipalities in the north to be a part of the association, really to give it true autonomy. But I didn't hear a lot of people saying that, and the advisor to the mayor of Gračanica specifically told me that his municipality would definitely be applying to become a member. The Pristina sides know this, that this is not an easy task, but the Ministry of Local Government says it will be a staggered process of going through legal, institutional, service, economic integration, and then hopefully social integration. There is increasing movement between the north and the south. The management team is now being paid by Kosovo, and apparently they are being constructive about helping to sort out the drafting of the municipality budgets for next year, which has become a big issue. There is also an argument that the association cannot be created until the municipalities are correctly created, which hasn't happened fully yet. But for as long as it is not an established institution and it is increasingly politicised, the media has a field day in undermining any confidence in the agreement. One of the main problems with the establishment of these new authorities in the north has been considerable, both due to the issue of symbols, the continual functioning of parallel authorities undermining them, but largely due to the problems of transferring a fully different system of governments or local governments, and there being no real attempt by Pristina's side to train and provide information for these four municipalities. Albeit they haven't had much time. And in the south, municipal preparation teams were created to prepare the new municipalities in advance. The Pristina's side will argue there was no time for this in the north, where the municipalities are having to change from the Serbian to the Kosovan system overnight. And the drawing up of the questions of the budgets over the last few months has been a graphic example of this. A, the councillors and the people working in the municipalities had no idea as to how to draw up the budgets, and B, because they're still trying to factor in what other funding they might get, it's complicating the situation. Finally, as the last point says, an implementation committee will be created. An implementation plan was created by the implementation committee, but if you look at it, it seems to have lost it, yeah. You will see it doesn't bring any confidence into the process anyhow, because of there's nothing. But having said that, most people wouldn't have seen it to read, because it's been really difficult to find. But this is actually a document with no dates in it. It has no dates in it, but it is an implementation plan. So what has normalisation delivered? Generally, on a dry analytical basis, I would say...
I think it's...
Yes to Europe. Yes to greater cooperation, but that is purely a relativistic judgment, and the jury is still out on whether it has improved people's lives. What is the more public perception? It depends on whom you talk to, but generally the people from both communities think that it has made things worse. The Serbs are all quite adamant that it is not what they wanted. They would rather be in Serbia, and the agreement has made them accept something worse and not better. In the north, the people feel let down and deserted. They say they believe Belgrade would stand by them, although they had long seen that Belgrade was deserting them. But there had been no one. There had to be someone to believe in. As Adriana Hojic, the director of the administrative office in the north, said last week, people feel victimised by high politics. They want jobs, and they want to know what agreements mean for their lives. No one is telling them, and there's a big problem of fear of losing salaries, because a very large percentage of the people in the north are employed in the public sector and have been receiving two or even three salaries. It is not to say, however, that amongst the northern Serbs there are not people who want to try and make it work, find in theory some consensus. And when this question is asked, caveats are usually thrown up. Oh, there have been elections in Serbia with a resulting change in government. In Kosovo, there were elections in June, but still no resulting government or functioning parliament. And of course, there were elections in Europe as well, and you've had a change of all the positions there. I'm not convinced by these excuses. In September, however, there was a bit more activity, and the implementation process was given a bit of a push, and progress, especially on energy, was made. As it is a process, it would take time. But I think we can fairly say it has certainly started, and there has been some progress. But let's look at it in its letter and its spirit. Although I have to confess that when I started to think about this a bit harder, I began to wonder if there ever had been any spirit. But many of my conversations over the years gave me grounds to believe there was a belief in the need to bring people, the communities, closer together. I think this can, to a tiny extent, be seen in the establishment of the municipalities, albeit only in small drops at the moment. But there is more contact. There is greater administrative influence from Pristina, for example, on the budgets, on the transference and training of staff. But its writ is no stronger there than it was. It has no physical presence there. We can box tick and say, yes, this and this and this was done, but people do not feel it has improved their lives. In fact, it has probably made some aspects worse. Hopes have been raised and dashed. But for me, there are a few fundamental issues over the spirit. There is no ownership of the process, either by Belgrade or Pristina, in the sense of delivering a vision to their people, and even the EU. There was no attempt to include the Kosovo Serbs in the talks. Now, all sorts of excuses and all sorts of reasons were given for this. But the result is that it means a lot of people in the north have a license to be unconstructive. And it also means that a lot of people feel quite simply disenfranchised. Belgrade has used the process politically to further its own ends and has in effect put its own placement in and disenfranchised Kosovo Serbian elites, which were beginning to evolve and had some commendable approaches. The municipal election saw the creation of a group called the Civic Initiative Srpska, which was basically a group of pro-Belgrade loyalists, many of whom had been in the parallel institutions, who got the backing of Prime Minister Dacic at the time, and who after the elections called it a victory for Serbia. Dacic also openly played up the association, saying that the Serbian government planned to open an ASM office, an office of the association in Belgrade. The Civic Initiative won the elections in all the municipalities except for one, in effect dismantling the other Serbian political elites who were considered to have been integrated and who had evolved since 2009. As one of the politicians said, "We thought the agreement was about integrating the North, but now it seems the risk is to have the already integrated South disintegrate." And some of these Belgrade supported candidates call their integrationist counterparts Thatcher Serbs or traitors, which caused a lot of hard feeling. There has been much criticism of this both by the Albanian side as well as the Kosovo Serbs, who lost their political jobs. I think we need to be careful in making these judgments because elections can always reap changes. And just because these guys were in the parallel institutions, if they were, it doesn't necessarily mean that they were ineffective or necessarily bad. The important thing is that the elites on both sides should come to show respect for each other, but it is probably still too early for that. I do not feel, and I choose my words carefully, Pristina has shown any real desire to reach out to the north and other Serbian communities, to include those inhabitants of its state as fellow citizens. It has made no attempt to go up to the north to talk to people there and to hear their views. The people in the north especially feel isolated, and it would not be rocket science to go up and fill the gap. There is a space to try and win hearts and minds. People argue that there is no government in Kosovo now. My argument is there is a government, and even when that same government was not a so-called acting government, it still showed no desire to go up. Recently, when talking to two Kosovo Serbs in the north, who are quite active there, they said to me two things which I thought was quite interesting. One was because of these discussions around a new coalition of parties in Kosovo, that they hope actually that Veta Vendosja now will finally come because they've said that they will talk to us. And they also said they cannot understand how, having been so badly treated by the Serbs, the Albanians are now wanting to do the same. And I hear quite a few of these anecdotal remarks. One government minister did, however, brag to me that he had finally gone up a few times, but I think that was only to do with negotiations with the Lista Srpska, which was the party which came in the parliamentary elections. The Kosovo government must develop a plan to talk to its citizens in the Serbian communities and not just to Belgrade. And finally, the EU. The EU has to take ownership of a somewhat shoddy-looking agreement. It may have only been a facilitator, but it was facilitating it as it had very specific reasons to do so. I have no doubt in my mind that there is work going on in the background, but this ambiguity has led to different interpretations. The European External Service handing the Prime Ministers the tasks of informing their public led to misinformation, myth and politicisation. And this combined has led to fears, insecurity, which can be the seeds of social tensions and even violence. The EU is mismanaging. It is not visible. It is incredibly micromanaged at the moment. It is undermining, I think, totally undermining itself as a political institution and the values it represents. At a conference on Friday last week, when BN, the Book Investigative Network, produced their paper called The Big Deal, which is a summary of normalisation, nobody from the EU came. But they sent a letter. The EU has to use its leverage. It has to remember that it had two main aims. One was to improve people's lives. In 2012, in the Commission reports, it talked about outreach. It doesn't now. And I think this is perhaps where the spirit point must come in. Europe is not just a destination, and this has to be explained clearly to the peoples of Kosovo, but it is a set of values, and these values include the respect for human rights, equality, integration, good neighbourliness, etc. The new High Representative Mogherini has said she would chair the dialogue. She needs to put new impetus into it, listen to more than just the politicians, and use EU leverage to ensure all the outstanding agreements are quickly implemented, in particular the corps. Kosovo and Serbia had made commitments and are not fulfilling them. And I think with Serbia, she can use the Chapter 35 opening. The EU should put much more pressure on both sides to take ownership. This is basic Copenhagen criteria stuff. And the reports of this year should have been much more forthright. People are not going to see a quick advantage, but a co-socialisation process is being slowly developed. There will have to be a lot of hand-holding to enable the ethnicities to cease to fear each other. The talks will have to be continued, and on the document you can't see that, the implementation one, that does actually say at the very end, we will carry on talking. I don't know why it's in there, but it does. The talks will have to be continued and new issues resolved, for example, the question of railways, airspace, bank and pension savings, the post office. I've spoken for long enough, and I think on the issue of whether this is an example to follow up, I think you must realise I don't feel this is an entirely valid question. It is really the implementation of the comprehensive proposals we are looking at. Yet obviously, it's obviously good that the EU has taken up the cut task and enlargement gives it leverage. But the important thing is that leverage has to be credible. And I think I will stop on that point.
Thank you very much.
We have now about half an hour for questions, so... Well, Joanna is very keen to point out it's not so much questions, she wants discussion, so comments are very, very welcome as well. Alexandra, if you could perhaps just identify yourself.
Yeah, I'm Alexandra, I'm from Cardiff University, PhD, and my research is mainly on the Serbia and the European integration process. So my question is, you mentioned that the agreement, the Brussels agreement, implied recognition of independence. Do you think that when the normalisation process is finished, that this means that both sides would have to recognise, well, that Serbians would have to recognise Kosovo in the end?
Well, when I said it implied recognition of independence in the sense that people believed that because they were having to interact more with the Kosovo institutions, that this was a form of independence. This is an issue which is going to hover, I think, in the air for a long time. And I don't think needs to be resolved at this stage. I think, and I say this personally, that when it comes to finally accepting Serbia as a member of the European Union, some formula will have to be found. But I also think and know the EU can actually be quite creative in doing these things. And it's not exactly taboo, but it's just not spoken about. But I think both sides slowly realise that it will eventually be resolved. And I think what we have to remember as well is it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen quickly. So there's a long time, or a lot of time still, to see what could develop, how relations develop. So it could even be a slightly academic question.
I'm going to abuse Chair's privilege and ask a question myself, and it's about the association of the Serbian majority municipality, which I think is a sort of very, very important clarification you gave there. You touched on one of the points that just keeps coming up, which is a fear that exists of creating another Republika Srpska. And it's a very interesting fear that's taken hold, because I've never heard a single international figure say we want to create another Republika Srpska. I think everyone can agree that the last thing anyone needs in the region is another Republika Srpska. You know, a model that would be far more effective would be something like South Tyrol. And you know, the obvious difference between the two is that Republika Srpska is where you create an entity and then you give that entity control over the central government. You give it blocking veto powers over key decisions on a day-to-day level, whereas a South Tyrol model is where power is devolved down and it controls its own affairs, but it can't actually interrupt the running of the state. And yet, despite the fact that no official has publicly advocated this, no one has taken steps to try and challenge that view that seems to have emerged in Kosovo Albanian society about you know, the role of the municipalities, that look, it doesn't have to be a Republika Srpska. No one's coming out, and they're almost allowing this. Oh, well, when it was at the height of its discussion, I mean, as you quite rightly pointed out, there's been no movement for about 18 months on this. So it's gone much, it's much more dormant. But I remember when the discussions were being happening, no one was coming out and saying, look, nobody's thinking of doing this. You know, you can rest easy on this. We're not going to create another Republika Srpska. Why do you think that was?
Well, I understand. It's not really whether I think, because, as I say, I'm not well informed enough on the Serbian side to have a real view. But this was for political reasons on the Serbian side, partly also to gain support in the north and gain support in. It's for purely political reasons. It does not seem clear from particularly one conversation I had this time in Pristina that the Serbian side is quite as intent as the media and they themselves make themselves out to be. And that was why I think I said somewhere they might be looking for the right moment, political moment, to slightly climb down. And you're absolutely right. But this gets thrown up a lot by the media as well. It was thrown up a lot during the elections. You know, it was Dacic who said these things during the elections, especially in the municipal elections, that this wasn't about recognising an independent Kosovo. We are never going to do that. These elections are about Serbia. And the other side doesn't have particularly constructive arguments either. I mean, it doesn't help very much when Thatcher says, no, the association will just be an NGO. And as somebody said the other day, well, you know, this is a local government association, so it can hardly be an NGO. And I don't think the international community has really come in at all on this. Now, there are working groups, and there is a working group now which is working on the association, and that does include internationals. So we'll have to wait and see. But I can't No, I'll leave it there, because I'm not strong enough on Serbian politics to really have a specific view. The only difference, of course, also with the Southern Tyrol situation is you have, in that Southern Tyrol, you have three communities, whereas, of course, the North is very much just Serbian.
I saw
Bernard
first.
I don't know much about this area, but a lot of what you were saying reminded me of the good old days when I used to live in Berlin when it had a war government, and some of these things about who moved where and what signs were accepted by who, where different people had different things and what. I was very much reminded of that. Some of it reminded me a little bit about some of the things which I see in Cyprus and some of the discussions about resolution of that. Some of it reminds me of these external bodies who somehow seem to be offering some kind of hope by attracting resolution as part of joining some other club. And I was sort of intrigued by this role of Brussels playing some sort of intermediaries. I was intrigued by a remark which you kept on using earlier on about bringing them closer to the EU as though they were both being treated sort of in equal terms. And it kind of reminded me again of some of the things which happened in the run-up to the Annan plan for Cyprus and Cyprus's membership of the EU and how that came to a sticky end. Some of what you talked about when you talked about sort of documents which had footnotes and asterisks to them remind me of things which went on. I used to work at the OECD and I still have to do with them. They have Israel as a member, and all the documents that you get now with the OECD are replete with stars and footnotes every time somewhere is mentioned which says, well, we're talking about this, but we reserve our judgment about whether we mean that or that, and that's left to something else. I've also seen this in EU documents with respect to Cyprus, which says this is sort of what we're talking about Cyprus, or this is what we're talking about Cyprus, and it depends on who we're talking about. So people are creating this kind of illusion here that somehow there is this thing here outside which possibly has a resolution intent. I'm quite sure that the OECD, when it got Israel as a member, hoped that this would one day smoothing the problem about what was Israel and who was in Israel. It was certainly the case we know about in the history of Cyprus. And then we get to this very bizarre situation, and this is what I really loved about it. I loved that agreement, because I thought, who actually wrote this wretched thing? It was not written in Albanian, it was not written in Serbian, it was written in somebody else's language by somebody else, and as you said, a whole lot of it was also written in the passive mode. And all of this means you kind of think, well, who the hell is actually responsible? Who has ownership for a document like this? Absolutely no one. But I then think, you know, kind of who had ownership of the situation and the solution that people were proposing for Cyprus? Who has ownership for these attempts by bodies like the OECD to think that they can sort out something to do with what the borders of Israel are? Etc., etc., etc. And I do want to sort of say, can we think of this in broader terms, and is there some lesson that we can get from that? Is there something we can learn from elsewhere?
I mean, one of the problems with the EU and the asterisks and things is not all EU member states recognise Kosovo. And this is one of the reasons why these issues come up. So you have Romania, Slovakia, Greece, Cyprus, Spain not recognising. Did I miss one out?
No.
And this then creates a lot of dissatisfaction within Kosovo itself. And I think if that wasn't the situation, there wouldn't be so many, even if there was an asterisk, there wouldn't be quite so many problems around this. Whether this is an example for other situations, yes and no. I would have thought, as far as the EU is concerned, and under the Treaty of Lisbon, the role of the EU has changed in foreign policy, and this is one of the first battles that they've taken up. And I would have hoped that the EU could have had a more constructive approach to it, because it's part of decided that these countries can be on the accession process. So it has to be part of that process. But they don't seem to really want to take, as you said, ownership of it.
Who's they? Sorry.
The EU. The EU signed, got Thatcher and Dutchett to sign this agreement and then told them that they had to explain it to their publics. And that was really when the problems began, because they have never been, not only have they not been explained properly, you can now, 18 months later. To find that document, you have to go onto the National Assembly website. It is attached to the Ratification Act. And it is then translated into Serbian and into Albanian, and as we probably know, not brilliantly. The reason why Kosovo is having a problem at the moment with the creation of a government, a problem of politics, is because the constitution was originally written in English and then translated into two other languages, which you need an awful lot more asterisks for. So, generally, I would hope that in situations like this, the EU can be a facilitator, but they have to be prepared to maintain that role and play it more robustly. I mean, I'm told by the Ministry of Local Government that they ask the EU for advice and they won't give it.
Just on a very quick, not that Cyprus is actually a very good model for anything when it comes to conflict resolution, but in actual fact, on this, there were some very interesting elements that did emerge from Cyprus at the very early stages of the dialogue. Not least of all was about movement of cars.
Yeah.
Because that is something that anyone who knows the Cyprus example is very successful. Greek Cypriots can take their cars over to the north, Turkish Cypriots can bring their cars over to the south. They worked out a mechanism for insurance, and it's certainly a lot cheaper than it is in Kosovo. So there have been little areas here and there which were incredibly useful.
You can't do it as a tourist.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it with a hire car,
but you can do it. You can do it as a Greek Cypriot. You can go to the north with your car, and as a Turkish Cypriot, you can come, which is really what matters, rather than letting tourists cross over. Frankly, it's all right. You might want to have a tourist hire car, but for most people, and that was actually a very important element. Sasha.
Okay. Thank you for your presentation. I would like to focus follow on this EU. Facilitating this process, and how do you see these recent events about Eulex, how they can affect the credibility of EU to be involved in this process, and is this somehow related to the political stalemate in Pristina and in forming government over there?
I'll take a couple more questions.
Can I just... is what related to the political stand?
I mean, the Eulex, you know, this crisis, is it... this can be related to the, you know, stalemate or...
You're referring to the recent allegations about high-level corruption in Eulex, which, you know, from the British whistleblower, right. Gentlemen there.
Arvind says to you, you talked about Pristina being reluctant to incorporate the North. I'd like you to clarify your points on that. And my question would be, how much impetus can they put behind that when the North is very reluctant to recognise Pristina?
You want to ask these two, and then we'll try and do another.
Eulex has never had a particularly good name in Kosovo. And that's partly because originally it wasn't seen as being effective, and then partly because of the work it took up, especially on war crimes and some of the criminal investigations. And what has happened over the last few weeks around these allegations against the judges has just added more oil to the fire. And again, the media has had a field day on it. But I'm very reluctant to make any comment on it until we really know what has happened. The EU is now doing an investigation into it. And I haven't followed it very carefully, partly because actually I find it easier not to know too much about it and then get involved in the discussions when the work I'm doing in Kosovo at the moment is very much meant to be outside of politics. But I do feel very strongly that we can't really make comments on it until we know really what's happened. I think it is extremely unfortunate, however, that this bad impression that ULEX makes, rightly or wrongly, because some of the work they've done has been perfectly in order, it does then reflect on the EU and Europe, yes. To my knowledge, I don't think it's had any sort of impact on the government formation or lack of formation. I don't think I said that Pristina was reluctant to integrate the North. Pristina, what I was trying to say more is it hasn't made any effort to do what we call outreach, to go out and set up quite small human relations, reach out to what we call the hearts and minds of people in the North. It's interesting that in 2012, in the Commission report, it is suggested that the Kosovan government should do this. And at the time, there was much more discussion about this in the international community, because nobody from Pristina goes up to the North to try to talk to people. Now, it doesn't have to be done as some... I mean, I know Editha Tihari eventually went this year, but she sort of went off as a one-off thing, and perhaps it wasn't the best way to do it. They haven't done it very much in the South. When Cecil was Prime Minister before independence, he used to speak on the radio once a week, and he always spoke in Albanian and in Serbian, and that made a difference. Haradinaj also made a point of doing a bit of outreach, and it made a difference, because that there is no feeling really amongst the political elites in Pristina of what the moods are up in the North. But they certainly want to integrate it, obviously, yes.
Okay, I'm going to take Misha and then Denisa, and then I'll take a couple of... Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of people's hands now going up towards the end, so I'm taking the ones in the first round. And if you could keep questions, please, short.
Okay, there was a mention of Republika Srpska. Nobody wants it, but there is a reason why it is there. You've spoken about these majority councils. But the Kosovo census of 2011, as well as the OSCE field estimates, show that 80% of the Serbian population that once lived under the river Iba is no longer there. They're registered as refugees in Serbia. Hardly any have returned. NATO, many of them have effectively been ethnically cleansed, while NATO was present. It was in their presence. So NATO countries have taken part there. I have here a list. This is an OSCE population estimates 2010. I cannot see a single municipality south of the river Iba that has a Serbian majority. You mentioned some. Maybe there have been, some time ago, but that is not the case. And in fact, one simple question, because that is used in Bosnia. Are they taking into account previous majorities are they taking into account now things based on the 2011 census? And on the issue of Republika Srpska, because I'm speaking from a Serbian side, if the Republika Srpska was not around, there would be as many Serbs in Bosnia today as there are currently in Croatia and are currently in Sarajevo, which is now an ethnically pure, pretty much all Muslim town. So please bear that in mind when you speak about these things. Many people in Serbia said, if you don't want Republika Srpska, it really means you don't want any Serbs there. I mean, the biggest ethnic cleansing operations have been carried out against the Serbs and with international support. Sorry about that. Okay.
Yes, I have a question about... Sorry, Denisa Kostovica. About the EU integration. So, and about sort of the commitment issues. Why would Kosovo commit to the implementation of an agreement where Serbia and Kosovo are in such different positions towards the EU? Kosovo is mm-hmm. so much further than Serbia, right? And if, you know, it would be easy, you can easily perceive that implementation of the agreement actually helps Serbia, whereas there are no guarantees that then Serbia would be supportive of Kosovo's accession to the EU, which is the dynamic that you see now between Croatia and Serbia, whereas Croatia from inside is now putting new issues on the table for Serbia.
Do you want to take those two and then we'll do one final?
Cyprus paradox.
I mean, I can understand the logic of what you say, absolutely. And there is an increasingly strong feeling in Kosovo that the Serbs are getting not only more out of it than the Kosovars are, but they're being held to ransom too, yes. But I think and people there will think the same way as well, but Kosovo is on its path to the EU and the government fully supports that. It knows that it will take time and it uses it as an important political argument as well, and I think the wider Albanian issue of coming into the European Union is also important. The three entities, not that they're getting there, but they see themselves as coming in together. But as I said earlier on, this is going to be a long and a slow process. Maybe we should ask ourselves the question again 5 years, a bit later. But hopefully they will stay on that path because it is an important pressure and path for the internal democratic and economic reforms. And of course at the moment there's also the visa liberalisation. But they've set themselves back because of the failure to create a government and the failure of the institutions. I mean, that what we're talking about, I think, will pale in comparison for a bit because of the questions following the election. Yes, I mean, we don't know what the demographic statistics of Kosovo are. I agree with you. There's a problem around the census. It was boycotted. And it is a problem because also one of the things that the comprehensive status proposals say that before supervised independence is completed, there has to be a review of the municipalities, which is based on a census, and it hasn't been possible to do.
The census has been carried out in the south. I mean, the results have not been published yet. I think the results probably have been published as well. But there was a boycott in the north.
There was also some boycotting in the south as well, and the results were published 2 years ago.
Mm. Okay, I'm going to take a final round, but please, please, can you keep your questions very, very quick?
Yes.
Lily,
there. Hi. I was just wondering, because the EU has been seeking to improve the lives of people in Kosovo, Serbia, to more economically, rather than trying to, say, work more in terms of security. Do you think that the EU is being more reluctant to solve the northern problem because they believe that these two countries are potential candidates and eventually that the borders will not be a problem in the future?
Gentlemen,
Do you believe this normalisation process would have occurred without EU facilitation and demand for it in Chapter 35? And if so, to what extent would it have been so successful?
Big question there. Lady there.
Heroina Pilyaku from the Embassy of Republic of Kosovo. Just a little remark, because it was mentioned a couple of times that there was not enough outreach from the government of Kosovo. There is a plan in place by the government of Kosovo to do outreach to the north, as well as there is a fund that has been created as a result of the dialogue, and there is already around, I'm just guessing, around 3 million euros in that fund that were that came in from the customs and from the VAT from the northern borders. So it's just a little comment from us.
Thank you. And very quickly, please.
Okay, 20 seconds. Based on the reality that the creation of Kosovo was enabled by the forced partition of Serbia, given that successive Albanian administrations in Kosovo have shown no desire to reach out, no real desire to reach out to the Serbians of Mitrovica in South Serbia and North Kosovo, depending on your point of view, is it not time to consider asking the Kosovo Albanian authorities to accept what the Serbian governments have been forced to accept, that is, the partition for peace, and through that concession to increase the chances of a stable peace in which both sides are given territory for peace, not just the Serbian side?
The biggest question is for last, I see.
I don't think I fully understood your question about the borders.
Yes, recently there's been this report from the EU that the reason why the EU is not focusing as much on the northern issue, on the border, is because they claim that both countries are potential candidates to join the EU, and therefore the borders are not going to be as big of a problem as they are now. So do you think that this is one of the reasons why there's not being as much support coming from the EU in this region?
No, I'm not quite sure what the EU is, exactly what you mean here by the EU's on the borders.
I think it's this idea that borders cease to matter in the European Union, so that's why the EU's not pushing it.
That's what I was going to say, yes. But I don't think that really impacts. That's been the same with all member states. And I don't think that impacts in any way. The EU is meant to be giving extra money to the north. They said nearly a year ago they were going to give, I think it was 38 million euro for the north. And we are still waiting to hear exactly how that money is going to be spent. Now, I don't think there's, because, you know, in fact, the problem for the EU, in a way, was the border issue, because normally, as you know, James has said, it's not an issue, and it's always been argued that coming into the EU would then make these issues that just be boundaries as opposed to borders, even if that. I think it would not have been possible, no, to have had the normalisation process without the EU. But I find, the EU's there. The EU is so much a part of the post-conflict sort of peace and stability process that somebody else, perhaps not Baroness Ashton, may have done it in a different way. But they had to take up the baton because they wanted, it was really important to help these countries move, you know, this was what, 2 or 3 years ago, but improve their prospects for coming into Europe. I doesn't mean to say that it would have been absolutely impossible, but it's too much of a hypothetical situation to talk about. Development fund. Yeah, the three, yes, but that's the development fund. And yeah, there's meant to be over 3 billion now there, but it seems to sit in the bank. And it's mainly, I think, for infrastructure work as well.
It's dedicated only to the north, and there
yes,
is
that's right.
The
yeah,
it's the
money from the yes,
the
yes, yes.
They're going to decide about.
I hope soon they'll start putting the money. But again, it's the EU is on the board, and there are all sorts of issues around it. And that's the thing, that there's a different funding for the north. There's the funding that comes from the Kosovo government, generally for municipalities, the development funding, and then whatever comes from Belgrade. I think it's been, well, we could theorise about this for a long time, but the normalisation process has accepted that there will be no change in borders. And I don't think there's any further discussion. And borders were set up and they're included in the Kosovan constitution as well, but they can't be changed, so it would be an enormous upheaval. And we've talked about these issues since I started working on it. And one of the first things I was told when I joined the Foreign Office, there would be a domino effect. So let's not go back to those arguments. But I think it's very clear. It's very clear now that the borders, nobody's asking for them to be changed. They might mention it politically, but it's not being discussed in Brussels.
Are they not stable this way?
Not stable?
No, I mean...
I wouldn't entirely agree. I mean, there has been no attempt to use force to change the borders.
Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of this evening's session. Before thanking Joanna again, I'd just like to make a couple of very quick announcements about two events that we have coming up in 2 weeks' time. The first is on Monday, the 1st of December, when we're going to have a panel discussion on the Romanian presidential elections, and that will be held here. And as I say, that's Monday, 1st of December, and at 6 p.m. is it? Great. We will be putting up notices of all of these on the LISI website. And then our final visiting speaker for this term is on Tuesday, the 2nd of December, so the day after, again in this room. And that will be John O'Brennan from the National University of Ireland in Maynooth. And he's speaking on the subject of normative power Europe in the Western Balkans, enlargement fatigue and the multiple challenges of maintaining momentum in the accession process. So a couple of good and interesting events to finish up this term. In the meantime, I'd like to just thank Joanna again very much for coming along, giving us such a good overview of the normalisation process and the Belgrade-Pristina agreement. I think, like a lot of us, that this will get back on track as soon as sort of political developments in Kosovo settle down. So certainly a subject which is going to be rolling on. So thank you very much once again for that.